Today is April 19th, and we are taping Bible Nation Near East. So, I gave you, you took those copies from the desk at the end of last class, I see. And there's an article on the Rosetta Stone, and there's an article on the Mesha Stone. Okay, the Mesha Stone is more Nogea to us, because that refers to a specific event in the beginning of the Malachim days, and that's the Bible Nation Near East. The Rosetta Stone, it's a little different. It's a little later than that. It's in Egypt, which is certainly fair game for what we've been doing all semester. Just that the one defining feature of this that will help us understand the whole purpose here is that everybody is Shabbos. Right? I don't mean that. Alright, so what appears at the end of the Rosetta Stone is something that I think can bear a little light on something in this time. Right? Well, frankly, I've never found anything that you can't connect to something in Tanakh, if you know it's not well known. But anyway, at the end of the Rosetta Stone, you have these elaborate menus and detailed lists of everything that everyone had to give over to the king. Right? Now, the Torah has very little in it about how we're supposed to treat the king. In fact, there's very little in Chazal too. Right? The Torah does have about 5 or 6 psukim in the beginning of Parshat Shoftim about a command to have a king. And since the Gemara in the second paragraph of Masechet Sanhedrin teaches us that there are some other mitzvahs we can't do unless we have a king, name two of them. The king is okay, fair enough.
Done.
So make it 3. The Gemara doesn't count Hakiel there. Destroy Amalek and build the base of Mikdash. You will not be able to do those 2 things unless you have a king. Now you understand why we waited 500 years to build the base of Mikdash. Why didn't we do that earlier? Why didn't we wait till Shaul to get a command to destroy Amalek? Why didn't we take care of business in Sefer Shoftim? Right? You get the point. So, as such, it would appear from the Talmud's conclusion that appointing a king is a mitzvah saseh, right? And what's your problem in a particular story in Sefer Shmuel? So why is it that when B'nai Yisrael went to Shmuel to, if not ask, pretty much demand to fulfill this mitzvah, what was Shmuel's reaction?
Anger.
He's angry. Vayicharav. At the very least, consternation. He was not happy with their desire to fulfill this mitzvah. So how do you explain such a thing? Alright, so I'm just using this in the end of everything. What's happening in the nation, and I think you already know this, when we contrast chapter 60 of the Code of Hammurabi, which talks about the fruits of your trees for the first 4 years belong to me, and in the 5th year, by my graces, I allow you to eat your own fruits. Right? See what Hammurabi is trying to establish in his law code, namely
slavery,
you can only exist on my
grace. Right, you exist, you live, you eat by my graces. Right? The king's required absolute power of this sort, where people believe they breathed and existed and lived because of the graces of their king. Right? And they demanded that kind of attention and obedience. Right? So those depictions of Paro and the way they had to stand before him, and it's like the mafia, the Godfather, everything in this, the whole nation exists by his grace. And the Torah lists a whole series of mitzvahs. A series of mitzvahs that are meant to transfer that from a human king to the heavenly king. Right? You're no longer slaves to Paro, now you're slaves to a Kodesh Baruch. Alright, you with me? So Rosetta Stone just goes along these same lines. You just see, otherwise you just your only sentiment of this is what you saw in the movie Joseph and the Dream of Joseph in Egypt, or the Ten Commandments, or or maybe some other movie where you can have an inkling of the way ancient kings behaved with their subjects. But here we see something real and something live that is that shows the amazing, tremendous tribute that people had to pay for their monarchs. So here, I tell you that there might have been some influence that crept into Israel. What does Shmuel tell Bnei Israel after they ask for a king? He says, Zeh yihyeh bishpat ha-melech. He says, you want a king? You sure you want a king? Why is angry in the first place with the desire to form a mitzvah is a little problematic, what we just said, right? But if you really want a king, then these are the rules I place before you. And those rules bear no resemblance to what the Torah says about a king, but bears very much resemblance to Rosetta Stone. Okay? Very much resemblance to some of these ancient societies. Open up Shmuel Aleph, Perek Tes. And you'll know why the Gemara in Sanhedrin and the Fafalov asks, what gave Shmuel HaNavi the right to depart so significantly from the Torah's picture of a melech? Right? He says, Zeh yihyeh bishpat ha-melech. You want a king? Well, let me tell you what he's going to do. He's going to take your sons and make them serve in his army. He's going to take your daughters and make them be bakers and dancers and singers and other things. He's going to take your tributes. He's going to take your fields. And he's going to take your vineyards. And he's going to take your houses. And he's going to charge confiscatory taxes. And then you will call out to God to save you from your king. And God won't listen to you. Are you sure you still want a king? Right? So the Gemara asks, what gave Shmuel the right to do this? So I say Shmuel HaNavi because it's Machlokas Rav and Shmuel. Rav says, Kol ha'amru b'parshas melech. Melech. It says, Kol ha'amru b'parshas melech. Melech asur bo. Shmuel was just scaring them. It's not the halacha. Shmuel, the Gemara says, Kol ha'amru b'parshas melech. Melech mutar bo. Whatever a king says, whatever Shmuel said in that parsha, the king is allowed to do. If you know your Tanakh, which made Tosfos ask the question, so why was Ahav punished for taking Naboth's vineyard? You all know the story? King of Shomron, so king of the northern tribes, coveted someone's vineyard. He asked for it. He said, I'll pay you handsomely. I'll pay you much more than it's worth. He refused because it was ancestral heritage. And the king had him killed. His wife had him killed. And of all of Ahav's terrible trespasses, that's the one that takes down his kingdom, says Eliyahu HaNavi. Haratzachta v'gam yarashta, very famous quote. He killed him and then you inherited his vineyard. So Tosfos says, why was Ahav punished? The vineyard is his. Shmuel Paskin, he'll take your vineyard. So take the vineyard, it's yours, you're the king. Tosfos gives six answers to this question. The simplest is, the one that really makes the most sense, is that this rule that a king can just by fiat take your property is only when you're the king of all of Israel. You rule over everybody. That would only be Shaul, Ishbosheth, David, and Shlomo. And the kingdom was split. But when you're not king, you're the king of the whole nation, there's another king who's rebelling against you. Right? There's not a king who doesn't hold from you. So you don't have the right to just take someone's stuff. You might argue, well, maybe he does have the right for the people who are in his kingdom. Anyway, that's one of those. Tosfos gives five other answers to this question of why. One of which is, because he asks. Once you ask and he says no, the king is not just willy-nilly mutter to do lotik no or lotik zol anytime he wants. Right? They should have done a better job of convincing him that you'll pay him anything. And give him a field three times the size right across the street. Okay? Anyway, it's Machlokas Rav and Shmuel. Now how do you paskin? Is there a rule that you would use to paskin whether a king is allowed to or not? It's Machlokas in the Amoraim, but how should you paskin? How should we paskin? So there are rules of psak. When Rav and Shmuel argue, the halacha is like Rav if it's Yisur v'Heter, the halacha is like Shmuel if it's Mamonos. What is this machlokas? Is it mamonos or is it isavadim? What does it look like? Can a king do what Shmuel HaNavi said he can do? Does that belong to Yerodea or does it belong to Kosher Mishpat? And how do we know how we paskin? Can you decide yourself how we should paskin? We don't have a king now, but what do you think a king should be able to do? Right? So, you can look at the Rambam. Rambam paskins that the king has the right to paskins like Shmuel. This is a din in Mamonos. The king has the right to do all this. I'm trying to tell you that it would appear that these influences about the power of the king seem to bear upon Israel, that we have a social contract with our kings that they're allowed to have these great liberties with what we own for his own purposes. Right? He's an evil king and he's using it for a holy zara or something else, all right? The prophet will come and punish him for it. But the king has those rights. But if you know your Tanakh, we're really all over Tanakh right now, there's one particular story that the Rambam quotes. It's in Sefer Yehoshua. When Yehoshua crossed the Yarden, entered the land, or actually it's even before he crossed the Yarden, some of the tribes came to him and said, "We see that we all agree except that you have taken upon the mantle of leadership from Moshe Rabbeinu. Anybody who defies your order, we all agree, shall be put to death." This is the concept known in Halakha and in the Gemara as Mori B'Malchus. You rebel against the king, you are hired. If the king drops something on the floor, you pick this up, and you don't, he has the right to kill you. The king tells you, go home to your wife, sleep with your wife. If you don't, he has the right to send you to the front lines to die. I'm talking about Uriah Achitza. Right? So, that's the Gemara. Okay. So the king has these broad rights the king that we see in ancient civilizations. The Gemara reads certain stories in Tanakh to go along with that. Now it's very interesting. This is probably a study unto itself, probably maybe a master's thesis. Is the evolution of how Chazal treat this concept as you go along from the earliest sources, the filter, Be'ikar Rava, Bereishis Rava, and Mishnayos, as you get to later sources, Talmud Bavli, Talmud Yerushalmi, Talmud Bavli, and even some of the later Midrashim, Midrash Tehillim, Midrash Mishlei, and you see an evolution of opinion that takes away more and more and more rights in this framework from the past. I don't know if you fully get what I'm telling you here, but you see that in early Midrashim, the king has a lot of liberties. But Chazal themselves watered down the rights of the king as you move along. Right? Be'ikar Rava, Bereishis Rava, Midrashei Halacha, written in the 2nd century, 3rd century, latest. Some of these other things I mentioned, you're written in the 5th century, 6th century, 8th century. And you see that as you go along, you can see comparable stories whereby, for instance, in Pesachas Megillah, when David, who's not even king yet, by the way, when David asks for some food from a man up north, Nabal HaKarmeli, does that story ring a bell with any of you? Guys, we're the people of the book. Why are all these stories such a mystery to everybody? Alright? So I know you learned it in 4th grade, 5th grade, but it's shy. I have to review this once in a while. So David asked for food from a man named Nabal HaKarmeli. The man refused. And David collects all his men to go and kill him. Who interceded to make sure that wouldn't happen? The man's wife, Abigail. Okay, so Abigail intercedes, and in the Gemara, she says to him, "What makes you feel you have the right to kill my husband?" So this is the Gemara talk. This is not what's written in the text. She does not have this conversation with him in the text of Shmuel Aleph Kerkov. She says in the text, "What gives you the right to feel you can kill my husband?" And he says, "Your husband is Morid B'malchus. I asked him for food, he refused me." So she tells him, "Lo yatzah tavachah ba'olam." He doesn't know you're king, that you will one day be king. This is where the Gemara Megillah Daf Yud Aleph says that she's one of the 7 Nevi'ot, right? But she this time everyone in Israel knew David would one day be king. Right? But he's already the son-in-law of the king. He's a fugitive now in the eyes of many, but they feel he's one day going to take over. So she says, "You're not king now. Shaul is still king. If my husband refused your request, that does not make him more of a Malchus." Right? She could argue, "You're more of a Malchus because you're going against Shaul." Right? So David responds to her and says, "Thank you. You saved me from a great Michshol." The Gemara actually uses by a certain Lashon that had he killed all of them, he never would have become king. Because he would have misused his power before he was king to do what he could have done. The conclusion of the Gemara is that if he was king, he could have done that to Nabal and his clan. Right? Do you remember this came up in the very beginning of the course, maybe in the first or second day? Tell me if one of you remembers. It was on the midterm. In the first section of the midterm, David said, if you don't give, I was about to kill off every mashkin bekir in your husband's household. And there was a question in the beginning of what that means. So in Wolf's book, he tries to prove from Aramaic that mashkin bekir means every resident of the city. Instead of what most of the fortune, like Rashi and Kara and others, and Radak say, every dog. Right? Mashtin, in the Gemara's Lashon, is urinates. Anyone who urinates on the wall, even every dog. Or man, at least. Right? Okay, so that's what David says this. And in the Gemara, Daffy Dahl, the Sakis Megillah, it seems that he would have had the right. It's just that you're not Melech yet. Okay? In an exactly comparable Medrash that appears in one of the latest Midrashim, it's called Medrash Tehillim, also known as Medrash Shocher Tov. This is a collection of Midrashim, all based on stories in David's life, the Prokem Zehim, where Abigail comes out to David and says, "My husband has been very insolent to you, David HaMelech." She keeps referring to him as David HaMelech. And he says, he tells her, "That's why I want to kill him." But she says, "Even though you are Melech," you see what's going on here? "You don't have the right to kill a man who refuses to give you food." And David says, "But he's Morig Malchus." And she says, "No, that's not within the category of Morig Malchus. Morig Malchus is like what Absalom did to him later, right? That's Morig Malchus. This isn't Morig Malchus. You don't have the right to steal." Right? And he convinces her. You see what's happening here? You see the evolution of how this measures? Are we just changing things around? Right? No, this is because an opinion came up about. It's Machlokis within Chazal. Of what animates her conversation with David. So you have the right to take a life of someone who refuses him monetary gain or something, or does he not? In the earlier source he does, in the later source he doesn't, even if he's king. Right? So here is what I place before you. The king that the Torah presents us with, anyone here to have a study in elementary philosophy class, you can play this in public, is like Socrates' philosopher king. The only thing the Torah tells him, speaks of him, is things that he can't do. He can't have too great a harem. He can't have too much money. He can't have too many horses, which means that he'll rely so much on his horses, and it may drive him to go back to Egypt, where horses were raised at the time, which Hashem doesn't want us to do. So, and the only thing the Torah tells him to do is to have a sacred Torah with him at all times. He's a philosopher. Right? He's supposed to have a Torah. Later on, the Torah says that everyone has to have a Torah. So he's got to have two. Right? And he can't bequeath one of them to his son. Every king has got to write a new sacred Torah. Wow. Look what the Torah feels about the king. It doesn't say anything about his liberties. Right? Okay, you get it? And then comes Shmuel 500 years later and tells us all about these things that the king is allowed to have. Shmuel's not going against the Torah by telling us about these liberties. Certainly not according to Rav, who said that Shmuel only said those things to scare them into retracting their demand for a king. Right? Okay, got it? Incidentally, Ramban, in his Perush al HaTorah, Ramban doesn't have a Perush, at least not that we have to say for Shmuel, but in his Perush al HaTorah, he says that what made Shmuel angry is that they said, "Nalanu melech l'shofteinu k'chol ha'goyim." give us a king to judge us. What was Shmuel's MO before he was Shmuel Anovi? He was
judge.
Shofate. He closes out Sefer Shoftim and makes the next stage to the written being. So to tell the Shofate, give us a king to be our Shofate, that's a real patch in the face. He was personally hurt. Because the next pasuk says, "Vayei," listen carefully, "Vayei Rava Einei Shmuel Kasher Sha'al Ha'om Tznon on the Melech L'Shofteinu." It doesn't say Kechol HaGoyim, the one to be like a Goyim. It says L'Shofteinu is what I am. The Ramban's Talmud, the Ran in Drosha Saran, you've heard of that Sefer Drosha Saran, the Drosha Yudalev. Ramban writes that their trespass was just what Shmuel sensed, that they wanted to give the king more rights than he's entitled to. What parsha does the parsha of Melech appear in? Born in Yitzhayim, it's called Parshas Shoftim, right? How does Parsha Shoftim begin? Shoftim and Shodrim, Titein Lechobacha, and then right after it talks about the Shoftim, it tells us, now appoint a king. What do we see from there, says the Bravanel? I mean, this is not bracket surgery here. But, yeah?
Yes, Bishop.
What?
Your king should be Shoftim.
Exact opposite. That there's a Shoftim, there's a Melech. These are two different institutions. There's the judicial branch and there's the executive branch. Don't mix the two. When you mix those two, you're giving too much power to a society. Right? So to say Tznamanu Melech L'Shofteinu angers Shmuel, says the Ran, that they are learning too much from the Rosetta Stone, which hasn't been written yet, to be sure, from that kind of outlook on the powers of a king, right? Which the Rambam said that in already in Sefer Yehoshua they were starting to say. But you see, in Yehoshua, it's just saying, listen, you need for very broad powers. We saw in the desert what happens with Korach, the kind of people and other people that make Moshe's life miserable. You need to have more power. So we're going to say, anyone who violates your word, right? It's high reason. Now, the fact is that in the desert, people who do run up against Moshe do come up to bad times themselves, but that's not part of a human judicial response. It's part of God's response. That was the Korah, that's the people who have Esav Utavo and Parshas Palos, etc. Raglan. Right? Okay, Adkan, the Rosetta Stone. I give you another reading about the Mesha Stone. Right? Make sure that over the vacation or at some point before the final, you've read both of these articles. Alright? The Mesha Stone is far more interesting for us in terms of its direct relationship on the Tanakh, is that it is, to be sure, the most significant archaeological find, since archaeology is a science, that bears directly on a Tanakh story by sheer size. There's a significant amount of material that tells a story that is found exactly with the same players, same places, as in Tanakh. The story in Tanakh is the beginning of Melachim Bet. The stone speaks about a king of Moab named Mesha. It's transliterated for you on that page into Hebrew, so that you can see that Moabite is extremely close to Hebrew. I believe that when we were when we started off to discuss languages early on in the semester, that I had mentioned to you the opinion of the Torah Tmima. Does it sound familiar? Torah Tmima in his sefer called Tosefes Bracha. Tosefes Bracha is like the Torah Tmima on the Torah and Chamesh Megillos. And this is what the Mesha Stone looks like. Shorter than the size of an average human being. Okay. This is spelled out in Hebrew. Okay, I'm going to read. Anach Mesha ben Kmosh Melech Moav. Come on, this is Hebrew. I am Mesha. Now it says ben Kmosh. You know from his Anach who's Kmosh in Moav. It's a god, right? He thinks he's Jesus. the kings thought that they were gods.
Right? So,
in Tanakh, Ben Elohim does appear. Bnei Elohim, they are, usually translate them as angels.
Lo al bar Elohim samichna. We do not rely on, what's a bar Elohim?
So Birnbaum in his Siddur claims that it was a swipe at Christianity. Probably not the shot. Bar Elohim is a terminology that you find in Bereshit already.
Yeru b'nei Elohim is benosa adam kitavos hena, right? The end of Parshas Bereshit. Who are those b'nei Elohim?
It could be aliens who came from other planets, maybe. I don't know. But more likely, strong men. Right? Anyway, I digress. He says he's the son of their god. And he writes about a battle that took place in the beginning of Malachim Beis. Same places, events. There's just one profoundly main difference between the two, which is, in Tanakh, we won the battle. In this stone, they won. History is quite subjective, is it not? But history gets to be written mostly by the Sephardim. History is usually written by the victors. Right? In this case, it doesn't matter who won this war that's described here. What matters is that there are descendants of the Hebrews, the Israelites, who are studying this today, like us. But there are no descendants of Moabites studying this. Now, however, the archaeologist trusts this source more than it's not. Tell me why. Because this stone, they have dated, and it's very pregnant from the Lutherans. So, 850 BC, which is the time, right? The stone was written by someone who witnessed the war. Now, does that mean he's telling the truth? No.
But it's a first-hand account.
It's a first-hand account.
This Tanakh that we're studying,
the one that I have in my hand, is taken from, well, now we have the Dead Sea Scrolls, but even if you're saying it's based on a Masorah that we know from the Dead Sea Scrolls are 600 years after these events took place. 700 years after these events took place. Right? The oldest Tanakh we have in our hands is from about the year 900.
Right? We don't have any, we didn't have the ways to guard.
Maybe the Vatican has some Christian Bibles, but those are translations. We don't have the originals. I don't have Yeshayahu's own handwriting. You know what I'm saying? We have a very good Masorah that we pass down from generation to generation. Right?
But
we don't have the originals. But here, let me tell you this. We have diaries from Polish infantrymen dated September 1st, 1939, saying we are advancing on German lines with our cavalry. Cavalry. Goodness gracious. The Warsaw Ghetto made a stand against the Germans longer than Poland did. Poland was lost within a few weeks. The whole country fell in a few weeks, but we have diaries of guys who probably killed on the front lines saying we're advancing on them. Right? So, look, who knows what this is? History is very subjective. Everybody at that time writes about only their good stuff. Right? You know what? I'll compare it to something in 1967. You ever read all the books? There are many books written on this. Why did Jordan join the war on the fourth day of the Six-Day War? Because even up to the fourth day, Egypt was broadcasting that their tanks are running through the streets of Tel Aviv. So Jordan says, hey, I want a piece of that. They were begged, stay out of this. This is not your battle. Went in and took over the hotel and everything else there.
Right?
But imagine that. On the fourth day of the Six-Day War, Egypt is still broadcasting how much they're winning. Right? Okay? So don't be surprised that Mesha would write of their defeat of the Israelites. Okay? Look, it's not finished. If you read Assyrian records of their conquest of Yerushalayim, you would be amazed that there are any Israelites left.
I'm not even talking about Babylonian records. Because by the time the Babylonians had destroyed Jerusalem in 586, right, there were plenty of Jews already scattered all over the world by then. Right? Okay, and in Nebuchadnezzar's case, he specifically allowed Yirmiyahu to remain with the community and appointed Gedaliah ben Achikam as their ruler. Right?
So I know that they survived Babylon, but you would think that they did not survive Assyria. Now, Assyria camped on Jerusalem also. And it seems that from their records that they destroyed Jerusalem too.
In our Tanakh, it says miraculously, hundreds of thousands of them, just 185,000, just wiped out. In our Tanakh, it says by the angel of death. There is an Assyrian record, not 185, but 135, 1,000
soldiers who just all of a sudden start frothing in their mouth and something terrible happens. And you know, how long does it take for one Ebola virus or something, the way they sent they did like the Japanese did, they sent tens of thousands of women to serve as their soldiers on elongated campaigns. How long would it take, the way we know germ theory, how for something to spread around an entire camp? Right?
So if I would ask a hashkafic reason why we've outlasted the Moabites, I would say because Hashem promised us. If I would ask a scientific reason why we've outlasted all these other nations, because of the sexual code. We did not do what those other nations were doing. Not in our own place, and not on the battlefield.
Okay. As far as the Torah Tzmima, this is a very interesting thing. He says that the reason why we have all of these confusions in Rus, Perek Aleph, between masculine and feminine. You ever open up Rus, Perek Aleph, and see that the author of this book does not know the first elementary difference between a man and a woman in Hebrew? The women are constantly being referred to as men. They say, Yas Hashem Imochem, Kasher Asisem Imamesim. The Rus, Naomi, and Orpah are constantly referred to as men. Right? With masculine pronouns. So the Medrash says they dressed up as men in order to get from Moab to Yehuda, which was a dangerous journey. The Torah Tzmimah says a pshat. He says, well, they were living in Moab. In Moab, he says, it seems to me that they don't differentiate between masculine and feminine. So when they were talking, they spoke just masculine. Right? Which is true in Hebrew. If you have two men and two women and you speak to of them, you will use a masculine pronoun. That's how it works in Tanakh. All right, so comes the Torah Tzmima to give a good shot why Rus Perek Aleph has all these masculine pronouns for three women. So the Mesha Stone shows that there is a differentiation between masculine and feminine. Torah Tzmima lived until 1933. He should have known. The Mesha Stone was found in the 1870s. Right? Okay, but it's an interesting shot to help us with our Shanut, our problem in Perek Aleph of Rus.
Okay, that's the Adkan, Rosetta Stone, the Mesha Stone. There's two things I gave you, and we're going to continue after the vacation with we have wisdom literature. You see, we did Mesha Stone. I want to do the Lachish letters, ancient coins and weights. We did actually earlier about Pim and Shekel and the 2/3 Shekel, the full Shekel. And but one thing that's going to be very interesting is the Lachish letters in Jeremiah 34. So over the vacation, this is what I want you to do. Read Hayes, Wisdom Literature. It's 41 pages, but okay, read as much as you can there, or all of it. And read Yirmiyahu chapter 34. So check them off. I see you're all doing it. Right? Okay, Yirmiyahu 34 as that's going to bear on the Lachish letters and Hayes with our wisdom literature. Okay, guys, have a great time.